Even before the Trump administration declared war on higher education, American universities were facing multiple crises, including attacks on free speech from both sides of the political spectrum, battles over the curriculum, and expectations that universities serve as adjudicators of civil rights and social identity claims. Titled The Embattled University, Summer 2025 issue of the journal Social Research and International Quarterly, takes an in-depth look at many of these challenges. It features articles by, among others, Judith Butler on academic freedom in time of destruction, Lisa Anderson on the therapeutic turn in American universities, and David Hollinger on the Republican Party's interest to keep the electorate's level of education low. You can find Social Research at www.socres.org. That's www.socres.org.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation Magazine. And this podcast is sponsored by The Nation Magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. This week, the sort of monster I wanted to take up is one of the richest men in the world who owns the Washington Post and is the founder of Amazon and has had some very controversial dealings with sort of the world of journalism and how he's running the Post. This is the subject of an article published by my guest, Pamela Alma Weymouth, in The Nation, titled My Grandmother Stood Up to Nixon. Jeff Bezos Should Take Note. As you can tell from the title, Pamela Weymouth is the granddaughter of Kay Graham, the legendary publisher of the Washington Post. In addition, Pamela is also a freelance writer and humorist. She's written for many places in addition to The Nation, including Truth Dig and The Huffington Post. She's written for The Stage, and she teaches journaling and resilience strategies to parents of children with rare diseases. She's working on a novel called The Mexican Do-Over, Lessons in Life, Death, and Heartbreak, and Hope. And you can also follow her on Substack at The Mother Battle. I'm very happy to have Pamela on because I think this is a very important story with wide resonance for what's happening in America. And first of all, welcome to the program, Pamela.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Jeet.
And maybe I think the place to start is, like, you know, this is partially a family story. And just to start with your grandmother, who I think many listeners will have heard about, but I think maybe it's good to get more of a background because she's a very significant figure in American history and in American journalism. So who was Kay Graham?
Well, so my grandmother, Kay Graham, was the daughter of Eugene Meyer, who bought the Washington Post in 1933 at actually a bankruptcy auction. And at some point, he decided to hand it over to Kay's husband, Phil Graham, who became the publisher. But upon Phil's death, which was a tragic suicide, she was then in the situation of becoming an accidental publisher. And so she became the publisher of the Washington Post during the Nixon era.
Yeah, and in that capacity, like, she became a legendary figure because of her publication of the Pentagon Papers, which angered the Nixon White House, and which was actually, in a lot of ways, the sort of cause for the next big thing she's known for, which is Watergate, that Nixon, angered by the leaks in the White House, authorized a series of burglaries and crimes, became the Watergate scandal. And it was the Washington Post that really carried the torch. And there are two actually very famous movies where Kay Graham is featured in, one perhaps more prominently than the other. But there's the All the President's Men, which is about Watergate, and the more recent Steven Spielberg movie, The Post, which is about the publication of the Pentagon Papers. So can you explain, like what were the sort of hurdles she had to overcome to, like, actually do these two, like, big events? One, the publication of the Pentagon Papers, and then also to really push for the investigation of Watergate at a time when a lot of other newspapers were not doing that.
Well, so she was under tremendous pressure from the Nixon White House, was pressuring all the media to abide to, and not publish the things that they didn't want published, the leaks from Watergate and the Pentagon Papers, which revealed a lot of things that the public didn't know about the injustices in the Vietnam War. And so she was actually, she was dealing with pressure from the courts, pressure from the Nixon White House, and then she had pressure, which I didn't really realize fully until I saw the new documentary, Becoming Katharine Graham. She was pressured by her board and her lawyers to not publish the Pentagon Papers. And at the same time, she was receiving information from her editor, Ben Bradley, and from the journalists, you know, the famous journalists Woodward and Bernstein, that this was an incredibly important story. And so actually it turned out that the New York Times was banned from the courts from publishing the Pentagon Papers. And at that moment, the Washington Post had to make a decision, and they called her, and she had to make the decision if she was going to go up against her board and her lawyers. And she was at risk of, you know, she was at great risk of losing the Post, of financial consequences, and the government and Nixon were threatening to pull her TV licenses from the cable stations they owned, which would have completely destroyed the Post. So she had to make that decision if she was going to go with the truth or if she was going to cave to that pressure.
Yeah, no, no. And as you mentioned, I mean, this is like a kind of very pivotal decision that she made, and a very brave one. And do you want to say, Elsie, a little bit more about that documentary? Because I think a lot of listeners will want to watch it. And like, what's the kind of story of the documentary, and where can they view it?
So ironically, the documentary is housed on Amazon, but it came out earlier this year, and it's called Becoming Katharine Graham, The Only Woman in the Room. And one of the things that I, you know, as her granddaughter, found very compelling, and one of the things that moved me to write this article, was that I found it an incredibly moving documentary, because in a lot of ways, I felt like it really showed the real three-dimensional version of who she was. Because although All the President's Men was a great movie, they completely wrote her out of that story, and they gave all the credit to the men, and they didn't include her role at all. And then The Post with Meryl Streep was very, you know, rewrote her into history in a lovely way, but it was kind of Disney-esque. And for me, as someone who knew her, there were pieces of her that I felt weren't completely conveyed in that. So for me, I learned pieces of this story as her granddaughter that I had never learned before. She was a tough woman. She wasn't a warm and fuzzy grandmother. And so I came to understand, by going to see the documentary with my now 18-year-old son, I came to understand how brave she was and all of the things that she actually had to overcome, not just politically, but also personally. She had suffered through the tragic suicide of her husband. She had been basically a housewife, and she considered herself a doormat housewife, and her husband had been charismatic and compelling, and everybody had loved him. And so she got thrust into this role of being the head of a company at a time when women were not heads of company, and she had no prior experience.
Yeah, no. It's just on a human level, like, it's a very kind of compelling story. And do you want to actually say a little bit more about, like, you know, your personal sense of her, like, as a grandmother? I mean, you mentioned, you know, like, this very formidable woman was not how people traditionally picture the, you know, grandmother that's baking cookies or whatever. But like what was her human presence like?
She was tough, and she was intense, you know. And the thing, one of the things that I came to understand a little more deeply from the documentary was she was raised by two really smart, brilliant people. But her mother was Agnes Meyer, and she was brilliant, and she was interested in art, and she had been a journalist and really a feminist before her time. But she wasn't a warm and fuzzy mother either. And So my grandmother didn't receive a lot of love and mothering from her family. And so one of the things that I came to understand better from the documentary, and also some really beautiful interviews with Warren Buffett, who became a great ally of hers and a support was how insecure she was, because she had been told her whole life by her mother that her voice was not important. And so she had all these insecurities. And as a grandmother, she wasn't great with kids. She was, you know, smart and interesting, but she had really high standards and a deep work ethic. And so she could be judgmental. And she, I think because she was hard on herself, she expected or believed that she needed to sort of mold and guide and correct. And so I came to understand from the documentary more deeply how she had to overcome her own insecurities in order to raise her voice. And so to me, that makes her decision even braver. And so the documentary really transformed my understanding of her, and especially in this time when we are looking at another president that is bringing pressure against the media and the choices that Jeff Bezos has had to make, I can see more powerfully how she had to tap into a bravery that didn't come naturally.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I think that's very compelling. And I think that's her story offers a lot of lessons for, you know, like how journalists should behave now. Now, as you mentioned, Kay Graham died in 2001, and the family sold the newspaper to Jeff Bezos in 2013. That was a period where a lot of big media companies, mainstream traditional media, legacy media, were struggling because of, you know, the loss of advertising through the internet. And so what were the kind of expectations that the, you know, the family had of Jeff Bezos when, you know, he purchased this like legendary newspaper in 2013?
Well, of course, it was a really heartbreaking decision for my family, but they wanted to do what was right for the paper in order to save the paper. And they believed that Bezos had the financial and technological wherewithal to kind of usher the paper into the digital age. And at the time, he made promises to honor her legacy. And he did pretty well for the first Trump term. And he even, there's a quote that at one point he even said, "While I hope no one ever threatens to put my body parts through a ringer, if they do, thanks to Mrs. Graham's example, I'll be ready." And of course, for those who know, he's referencing the famous quote by John Mitchell, the attorney general under Nixon, who threatened my grandmother, saying, "Katie Graham's going to get her tit caught in a big fat ringer if that is published."
That's right. Yeah. So I mean, Bezos, like from that quote, like clearly knows the history of the paper and the legacy of your grandmother. I was even like, you know, kind of citing it. And as you mentioned, I mean, I think, you know, what has to be sort of fair about this, Bezos, you know, like in that sort of first Trump term, I, you know, really did invest heavily in the paper. It is a newspaper that, you know, I subscribe to. It has like, you know, like many great writers who did like, you know, like sort of top-notch investigative work into both Trump, but also like, you know, the Obama administration, and then later with Joe Biden. Like you know, like it is what you would want. And investigative reporting in particular is like a very expensive enterprise. You have to pay reporters to do a lot of work for a long period of time that, you know, doesn't always pan out. Sometimes results in stories that are very important and like make the news, but don't like, you know, bring in subscriptions or don't get the clicks that you need for advertising. So he invested heavily in that paper. And I'll just mention, like, you know, like among the initiatives that he took, which was very important and sort of shows civic journalism at its best, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement and the sort of controversy about police shootings, the Washington Post instituted like a regular feature monitoring police shootings. And they tabulated for the first time really what the statistics are on police shootings, which is something that the government does not do, which is astonishing when you think about it. Like, you know, the fact that, you know, like anytime a government official kills someone, that should be news, that should be important. And certainly the matter of police shootings in particular are very urgent. And the Washington Post, you know, under Bezos, was the newspaper that really allowed people to get a sense of that. So I think you're right that a lot of credit has to be given to him for the first, let's say, 10 years of his kind of reign, where he was really, like, you know, doing what he promised to do, investing in a newspaper and investing it as a civic obligation, the way Kay Graham had run it. This is something, you know, you're doing on behalf of the public and not just as a profit enterprise. Do you want to say anything about that? Because I do think that we have to give, like, you know, credit where credit is due.
No, I think that's true. I think what's been devastating, you know, and disappointing to so many journalists and readers has been how he changed course in this in the second Trump term.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about that sort of turn, which actually I think, like, predates the second Trump term. It was already kind of evident in the sort of summer of 2024. So do you want to, like, just describe what has happened to the newspaper in the last year or so?
Well, yeah, as many people know, it began with the Post's failure to endorse a candidate. The Post had an endorsement, and they had been endorsing candidates for years. It was part of their tradition on the opinion page. And they failed to endorse Kamala Harris. And in response to that, they made a comment that the paper was going to return to its roots. But, you know, in reality, the roots of the paper, as planted by my great-grandfather, Eugene Meyer, and then followed up by my grandmother, Catherine Graham, were that the editorial page had editorial freedom. And, you know, even though my grandmother had famous parties where she mingled with politicians on both sides of the aisle, at the end of the day, she said they always knew that when they went home, the Post's duty was to the readership and not to loyalty to those politicians. And so I think that was the difference. And so when they pulled that endorsement, 250,000 readers canceled their subscriptions and countless journalists and talent at the Washington Post quit. And then it proceeded from there.
I think that the point about editorial independence is actually worth kind of underscoring. That what had actually happened was that the editorial board had written up, had made an endorsement, had written it up, you know, and this is the way it normally works, that the, you know, the owner of the paper has sort of, like, broad discretion about the course of the paper, but you hire an editorial board to exercise independent judgment. And they had come to that, and then Bezos had intervened to cut that endorsement. So I think that that was a very notable decision. As you mentioned, like, you know, like, led to a kind of large number of readers becoming disillusioned and canceling. What's your sense of, like, what the thinking was when he did that? Like, because I mean, obviously, just from a number of standpoints, it seemed like a bad decision. Like, for any publication, losing 250,000 subscribers is a very big deal. And then also the loss of credibility, as seen by the number of people that quit the paper, and then also the very bad coverage it got. So he took a real, like, loss for that. But what do you think he was thinking when he made that decision?
Well, a lot of people suspect that it had to do with his business interests, because like my grandmother, who had the cable TV stations, Bezos has even, you know, more business interests, and he's CEO of Amazon and the owner of his aerospace company, Blue Origin. And on the same day that the Post spiked its endorsement, Bezos met with Trump. And then on April 4th, Blue Origin was awarded a government contract of $2.4 billion to launch the Pentagon satellites into space. In addition to that, Bezos broke journalistic ethics again when he donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration and bought the rights to Melania Trump's docuseries for $40 million. And one of the things that I learned was that my great-grandfather, when he bought the paper in 1933, he wrote up a mission statement for the paper. He had a great deal of integrity. And he said in his mission statement, the newspaper, quote, "the newspaper's duty is to its readers and the public at large and not to the private interests of its owner. In pursuit of the truth, the newspaper shall be prepared to make sacrifices of its material fortunes if such course be necessary for the public good. And then finally, the newspaper shall not be the ally of any special interest." And that was the code of ethics that my grandmother followed. And so did my uncle and my sister when they became publishers.
Yeah, no, I think that's a kind of like a very crucial point, like in terms of like what actually a newspaper is and what its like obligations are. That, like it's both a civic institution as well as like a for-profit one, and there's like, like sacrifices that have to be made. And like, obviously, one reason why your grandmother's story is so compelling and has become this kind of like, really legendary story in the history of journalism is that she was willing to make those sacrifices. And I mean, I think there's a couple of points to make, which is one is that, it's not new what Trump is doing in terms of threatening newspapers. Like this has happens all the time historically, like both from powerful politicians like Nixon, but also like from vested interests like big corporations, big advertisers. People want to influence what's in the news and try to use their like clout to do so. And journalistic integrity, as your great grandfather indicated, is realizing that private fortune sometimes has to be sacrificed for those goals. I mean, it's a bit curious to me because I mean, like, obviously your grandmother and your family had a lot of money, but Bezos is by some measure the second richest man in the world. And like in some ways one would think that it'd be easier for him to make these sacrifices than it would be, even for other people who have, like multi-million dollars, but aren't quite in his stratosphere. Do you want to say anything about that? Like, what's the kind of thinking like of someone like him? Like, why was he so susceptible to this kind of pressure?
I mean, I can't speak for Jeff Bezos. I know that a lot of people would be really happy to see him stand up, And I know that thinking about kind of Harvard versus Columbia, Columbia caved and Harvard stood up. And the lesson was, even though Columbia bowed to Trump's pressure, they didn't really win anything in the end, And in the end, I think if Bezos was willing to backtrack and say he made a mistake, I think a lot of people would be really happy to see that. But I think it takes the willingness to sacrifice one's material fortunes and to be able to do that. And it takes a lot of courage to admit when you've made a mistake.
Yeah. No, I think both are right. I mean, this is in some ways a question of character, as much as anything. I will, to give some sort of context. This is like a wider journalism story, and what is actually seeing like many other media institutions kind of caving to Trump in this way. Not all of them, but certainly like CBS with the sort of, I guess, settlement that they just made with Trump over 60 Minutes, and many other sort of media organizations kind of like, sort of bending the knee to Trump. So I think this is like a more widespread problem. And your point about Columbia versus Harvard, I think is well made in the sense that, I for me personally, it's been distressing to see how many institutions and how many people like in sort of Wall Street, big law, journalism, academia have been caving. Do you want to say anything about that point? About like, what is perhaps the difference between like, the people who have shown courage and the other large, very large group of people who have not shown courage?
Well, I think that, what is scary right now is that in order to defend our democracy and to maintain the democratic principles this country was founded on, we have to defend free speech because the only way the voters get the information that they need is from our media, And it was interesting. I was rereading parts of my grandmother's book, and one of the things she said was that a pivotal point that really changed the American public's view around the time of Watergate was that Walter Cronkite finally went on the air and validated the Washington Post story, which a lot of people hadn't cared about or hadn't believed up until that point. And I think, the struggle now is we need more mainstream media that is going to get to people on both sides of the aisle. And we need the media outlets that are doing fact-based journalism and professional journalism to stand up and have courage in order to turn this election around and all of the injustices and the inhumane actions that are being perpetrated by the Trump administration. Because if the public doesn't understand the real facts of what is happening, they won't know how to vote at the voting booth.
I think that's essentially right, like in terms of the role that journalism has played. And I also want to talk a little bit, you know, on this question of sort of like bravery and standing up. One thing that I found very moving about your article, you know, in The Nation, "My Grandmother Stood Up to Nixon, Jeff Bezos Should Take Note," is that you quite properly take notice of the journalists who work at the Washington Post who have objected to what Bezos has done and who have, like, you know, both publicly rebuked him, which is a very hard thing to do, like, to your boss, you know, to sign letters criticizing him, and in some cases have, like, left their jobs. Do you want to say something about that? Because I think that, you know, like, when I was talking about sort of citizenship and responsibility, that's also a great example of people sort of doing their duty. And it's also something that, again, comes with a cost.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've been incredibly moved by and impressed by the courage of so many of the journalists who have stood up and those who have left the Post and then have spoken out. Some of the notable ones are Ruth Marcus, who wrote an extraordinary piece in the New Yorker magazine about why she left and how much she had deeply loved the Washington Post and how difficult it was to leave, but that she had to. Another, you know, extraordinary journalist, Eugene Robinson, wrote a really beautiful essay about the documentary and my grandmother and her courage. And one of the things that he said was, "I bow to her." And one of the things that I wanted to my grandmother for her courage, because she had not bowed to a president. And another notable, you know, extraordinarily talented cartoonist, Ann Telnius, who had won a Pulitzer Prize, did a very powerful cartoon in which she depicted Jeff Bezos, along with the other technocrats, kneeling with bags of money and bowing to Trump. And the paper refused to run that cartoon. And that was the first time, I believe, she had worked for the Post for 17 years and, you know, had never been censored before. And so she quit and she went on to win a Pulitzer for her courage. But there are a lot of journalists and people that work at the Post who don't have the financial ability to quit because they need to feed their families and they need their jobs. And so I really, you know, have so much deep respect for them. And I grieve for the struggle that they have to make between honoring their integrity and feeding their families.
Yeah, no. I mean, this is a very difficult situation. And I mean, like, to speak sort of personally, like, you know, like, as I mentioned, I'm a subscriber to the Post. And I've certainly shared the anger that many people have had, you know, and the question came up to cancel your subscription, which some of my friends and colleagues have done. But I also felt like, well, you know, there's still very good people at the Post. I mean, there's people whose journalism I sort of like rely on. And it seems you're put in a difficult position. Like, do you punish? I don't want to see those people punished as well. And I also want access to their journalism. So I think that what Jeff Bezos has done has also like put a real, like, created a dilemma for a lot of people, especially those who work at the Post, but then also I think a lot of readers and subscribers. Like, I think it does become a very tough question when you have such an essential publication. How does one handle that?
Yes. I mean, I think it is a dilemma. And I personally had considered or have considered canceling my subscription as well. And yet I haven't, because there are incredible journalists there who are really making the brave choice to continue to do really excellent investigative journalism in which they're covering all of the atrocities and the unconstitutional actions of this administration. And at the end of the day, I think, even though it's difficult, it's probably more impactful to cancel your Amazon subscription than it is to cancel your Post subscription. And I do worry that if everybody cancels their Washington Post subscription, then you lose a pressure. And that, you know, would it not be better for those people to be out marching in front of the building and raising their voices and writing letters to pressure on Bezos to honor the integrity of the institution versus just running and then not having that pressure to change.
Yeah, no. I think that's exactly right. I do think there's a real question of like what is the best pressure point? And then, I mean, ironically, like if you cancel your Amazon Prime subscription, which I would encourage people to do, but then you should only cancel after you've seen the documentary.
Yes, see the documentary and then cancel.
That's right. Which again, to me, one of the interesting points that this raises is the issue of the sort of concentration of wealth. Yeah, which, you know, like the United States, you know, capitalist society, unequal, has always been, had a lot of inequality. But there does seem to be a difference between a system where you have like, you know, like a fairly large number of family fortunes that often ran like the big newspapers, and a situation where like someone like Jeff Bezos has Amazon, has the Washington Post, has, you know, like all these other companies, and some of whose business is integrated with the government. That seems to be like a new and dangerous level of sort of like capitalist concentration, where you can't even have the degree of independence that one had in the sort of 60s and 70s. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like it does seem to you that there's been a sort of change or a significant shift, and that like it's the level of concentration as well that makes this all very problematic.
I mean, I agree. I think it's really dangerous. And when you start to mix business and money with journalism, you compromise journalistic integrity. And one of the things that I knew as a kid, you know, as a daughter of a journalist, was that you don't take gifts and you don't receive gifts from the subject that you're reporting on. And every journalist knows that. And Bezos has broken that basic journalistic promise.
Yeah, no, I mean, he absolutely has. And again, that speaks to the sort of concentration of wealth where you have, you know, he can do an Amazon documentary with the First Lady, and, you know, that becomes a kind of, you know, quid pro quo. And actually, I think a lot of the sort of big settlements that, you know, companies like Paramount are making with the Trump administration, I mean, one way to see them is like as these large donations, these large gifts, which is, you know, something, you know, you can't. But when you're dealing with a media organization, that becomes very sort of problematic. I wanted to give your like sense of what are sort of some of the choices or alternatives that are available, because I do think that in some ways, you know, as we mentioned, like the Washington Post still does great kind of journalism, as do other places like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. But it does seem like, you know, this period of like sort of like economic turmoil and loss of advertising and sort of the compromising of big institutions, like what has to sort of start thinking about alternatives or alternative ways of doing media? Like, do you have any sort of thoughts on that? Like, where can people like start turning to? Because as you mentioned, like, you know, like journalism is like a kind of essential feature of democracy.
Well, I think it's so important for people to support the media that is honoring their integrity, newspapers, magazines, online publications that are not bowing to pressure. We've got to support those. I also think that, I guess my hope is that at some point, I think the people on the right and the left have to figure out, how do we talk to each other? And how do we bridge those gaps? You know, how do we start reaching Fox News followers? Because I think if everybody's only reading The Nation and they're only, you know, listening to Fox News, we have this divided country where people are getting two different sets of facts. And that's the thing, you know, during my grandmother's age, everybody was reading the newspaper and everybody was mostly reading the same papers and getting the same facts for the most part. And so now we have this problem where people are following such divided news sources and often not fact-based news sources. And that leads to Trump's own voters who are being betrayed right now by him because they believed his promises.
Yeah, no, I think it is one of the really big problems of this time. Like, how do we kind of like create the kind of institutions that have, you know, or recreate the institutions that have kind of like withered away. I will mention, you know, like I think some of what you raise in your article and what you've said now, to me, highlights the importance of sort of like media criticism, especially in this age of like sort of like fake news and of sort of like partisan polarization, that we actually need to have like a more critical eye on the media. And I think one of the good things about your article is that, like, you know, it really lays out the sort of problems at the Post. And I think that one way of it's the whole question, who watches the Watchmen? Like if the journalist is supposed to be the watchman of democracy, then we also have to have someone who like watches them, or who is like, you know, turns a critical eye to them. And I think maybe that's a sort of thought to leave listeners with, in terms of, you know, we need a more critical examination of the media, particularly in a period where it does seem to be more compromised, and more kind of like analysis of where media is failing us, and where are the actual real sources of power that are compromising media.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, and my grandmother had a great deal of courage, and I just want to applaud the people like The Nation and the magazines and the journalists that are continuing to follow that courage and to follow the truth and share the facts with the American people. And, you know, that's what we want to see. And if there is some way for the Post to reverse course, and it's concerning the new editorial page editor who, you know, is kind of threatening to make the paper patriotic. And I think one of the points that I hope to make in my essay was that patriotism is honoring the First Amendment. And that is what my grandmother did. And that is the job of journalists and editorial pages, is to speak out when we see injustice, to speak out when we see our president and our people in power not honoring our constitutional rights.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think actually one of the lessons from your essay and from Kay Graham's life is, you know, I think people rightly feel that we're in a kind of like a dark period, but there have been earlier sort of like, you know, very dark periods where democracy was under threat. And in those periods, there were people who, you know, stepped up to the plate and did the right thing and did the heroic thing. And I think it's worth keeping that in mind as well, as like offering real lessons for, you know, how we're to proceed now. But like on that note, I want to, you know, thank you for your article. Thank you for reminding us of your grandmother's life and the lessons it holds.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor. And just, if I could just end with like one word, seeing people marching in the streets on the No King's Day, seeing the extraordinary amount of Americans from all different walks of life, gay, straight, rich, poor, elderly in wheelchairs out there holding up their protest signs, that gives me hope for our country that most Americans on both sides of the aisle do believe in our Constitution and want to protect it. And so I think that the journalists and all of us who stand up and speak out at this time, that is what is going to help save our country.
Yes, thank you for that. I think on that note of hope, especially on this sort of July 4th weekend, that's a good thought to keep in mind, especially since that has always been the real sort of source of American democracy and of all democracy. Like this is where one has to look for solutions, which is in the people themselves. So thank you, Pamela. It's been great talking.
Thank you, Jeet. It's been great. I appreciate it.